mind to the way in which we could. This attitude is not something Kenny always understood. He arrived at it over time, and part of it came from the two losses I was interested in talking about. Kenny had come into the first season of The Ultimate Fighter with just a few fights and a long history of Brazilian jiu-jitsu competition. He was a gifted black belt who trained in Boston with Roberto Maia and gone to Rio to train at Gracie Barra. He was the smallest guy on the show. Some of those guys probably cut 10 or 15 pounds. Kenny did well in the practice sessions and had his eyes opened to what MMA training was all about. When he won his first fight on the show, it was a bit of a surprise, just because he seemed so undersized and one-dimensional. He made it to the finale, against the much bigger and more experienced Diego Sanchez. Still, he was there as the jiu-jitsu guy, to see if he could win in MMA with his pure jiu-jitsu. I was so nervous. The real ability now is that I'm mastering that fear. I've had way more fights in the UFC than locally, so I did my growing up in the UFC, which is a tough thing to do. It was a blessing and a curse, a lot of doubt and fear, and the uncontrol was scary, but now I use that fear. It puts the pressure on me in a good way. The ability to make fear work for you is essential, and there are no shortcuts. It takes experience and time. The fights on The Ultimate Fighter had been televised, but there was a crowd of only 20 or 30 people watching in the room. Here, at the finale, was a stadium packed with fans. The pressure and the shock of the new took their toll. During the finale, it hit me all of a sudden. I was warming up backstage, hitting mitts, and 15 seconds into it, I am dead tired. My hands and forearms are cramping. They felt like lead weights, and I started to feel panic. I was trying to pump myself up, but I felt terrible. There's a camera in my face, and Dana White was wishing me luck, and all my friends and family, and the piss test, there's money. It was this huge blur. I couldn't understand what was happening. How did I get here? And then, suddenly, I'm in the octagon, and I say, what the hell to myself? And the fight starts, and I'm circling, circling forever. And I think, what am I supposed to do? And by the time I realize I'm in a fight, and I know what to do, Diego Sanchez is mounted on me. What happened? The fight shouldn't have been like that. I got beat before it even started. It was a classic example of the big show jitters, the nerves, for which experience is the only cure. Kenny took that loss hard, but what really bugged him was that he knew he could have done better. He'd done better against Diego in practice, and he'd held his own against all those guys in the gym who were more highly touted. Kenny's brother and training partner, Keith, said, "The cameras, the pressure, they got him in that fight." He said, "That wasn't me, and I can prove it." After the Diego fight, I said to myself, "I'm gonna try this. It's not about the contract, whatever. It's about me really going for this. I can be that MMA fighter." I knew how I did against Diego in training. I performed so horribly in that fight. I need to do this for myself. It became personal. He used the loss twofold, both as fuel to drive himself and as an instruction on what he needed to fix. Kenny felt like he'd let himself down, that he hadn't performed up to his potential, and it rankled him. He turned it inward and drove himself to become a professional mixed martial artist, as opposed to just the BJJ guy. He dropped down to the 155 weight class, for which he was still on the small side. Kenny laughs, "I usually end up cutting about 2 pounds, and I don't tell anyone because the wrestlers would all make fun of me. That's not a cut." At 155, Kenny proved a force and strung together a series of victories. And then he fought Sean Sherk for the lightweight title. Sherk, the muscle shark, has a nightmare style for anyone in the division. He's a hulking ballistic wrestler. He'd been a top contender at 170 pounds, but had fallen short against the top few guys. So Sherk dropped down a weight class. He is a titanic lightweight, muscled like a comic book superhero. He's a relentless takedown machine with great defense, good boxing, and limitless cardio. Stylistically, Sherk is a terrible matchup for almost anyone at 155. I still remember Kenny's entrance for that fight. He came in wearing full samurai regalia. He was the Ronin, the masterless warrior with a domed straw hat and a kimono. It was awesome. The kind of theater that is sadly lacking in the all-business utilitarian aesthetic of the UFC. He even had both the swords on, because only the samurai was allowed to wear both swords. Before I even fought in UFC, I always had a love for the samurai culture, the warrior mentality. They lived a very peaceful life. They were gardeners, painters, and poets. But when they went out and did battle, they were fully committed. I said to myself, if I ever got in the UFC, I would do the samurai thing. The fight went the way everyone thought it would. Shirk overwhelming Kenny with takedowns and ground and pound. Although Kenny did land a slashing elbow that had Shirk bleeding heavily the whole fight. Kenny couldn't stand up. He couldn't get away from Shirk. But he never stopped looking for a submission. He never stopped looking to win for 5 5-minute rounds. I got that determination from the Sanchez fight, he said. It allowed me to keep fighting. Even when it seemed hopeless, it never was. Kenny had gone in with a bad back, a recurring injury, but he never took refuge in that. In the fight against Shirk, I couldn't adapt to the way he was holding me in my guard. And I thought, wow, I can't stand up. I should have worked on that. And he's not giving me enough to submit him. He's being consistent with his takedowns. But it's too late now. I have to try and open it up, to do something crazy to open the fight up. I didn't have the tools in place to adapt. I had a hammer, and I needed a screwdriver. It was a hard thing to swallow, and Kenny was depressed for a while after the fight. But it led him to rethink his approach. He had to become a complete professional. You need to have a brutal honesty with yourself. Did I do everything possible to win that fight? What didn't I do? And analyze honestly, without bias from a technical standpoint. And then ask yourself, did I do everything in my training to prepare? It's about moving forward. We plague ourselves with stupidity, with bad thoughts. We put our brains in that prison. You can carry that fear with you, inside you, and it can keep you from changing for the better. Kenny continued, that loss drives me. Any loss I've had drives me. I don't think there's a day when I haven't thought about the Shirk fight. I never want that to happen again. It drives me in training. I changed a lot of things since that fight. Training happens all the time, every day, even without a fight in the future. It was a huge hole in my game. I didn't have a full-time strength and conditioning guy, and I needed to close that hole. Shirk was a real professional, and I wasn't. Since then, Kenny has worked with Kevin Kearns, his strength and conditioning coach, and made tremendous progress. He feels much stronger and more explosive. The injuries that plagued him have been rehabilitated. Against fighters that are supposed to be stronger than him, a deceptively stringy Kenny has shown plenty of pure strength. He's won several fights in a row, finishing all of his opponents. But Kenny's permanently dissatisfied, even in victory. I hate my wins. I just hate my losses more. I enjoyed the Sam Stout one. It was a coming out party. He just beat Spencer Fisher, and I knew I could beat him easy, and I did it. But I look back 2 weeks later, and I think, that sucked. That fight was a nice clean fight, no mistakes. But I don't think about the past too much. When I look at tape and I think, that sucks. What am I doing? My hand is up here. I'm ducking all weird. It's not pretty. Kenny went to Afghanistan in 2007 to train with some of the troops, as part of a program to boost morale that a company called Pro Sport MVP put together, originally with baseball players. The troops had requested UFC fighters, and Kenny answered the call. He thought it'd be interesting. Like any true student of the game, Kenny learned more from those he was teaching and interacting with than they from him. What impressed Kenny the most was the guys with beards. The special forces soldiers who grew beards to better fit into Afghan society. The real hardcore killers. They had the scars, the look in their eyes. They had seen the shit. But they were very professional about it. Kenny tries to verbalize the impression he got. This is the reality, and we accept it. We've been killing a lot of people, and we're satisfied with the job we're doing. They were matter of fact and passionate. They told me about their weapon loop. How you go to your rifle, then the enemy's rifle, then the sidearm, then your knife. In a fight, that's game plan A to B to C, but in terms of life and death. I looked around and thought, these guys must be on alert 24/7. They must be on alert all the time. They have to be. You see guys you know get killed, and how does that affect your intensity? I walk into a cage and get it, but they're out there every single day with it. I thought about it a lot, that kind of mental focus and clarity. Kenny remembers talking to Rob Kamen, a former Muay Thai superstar fighter, about it. They were discussing the self-programming. I'm nastier than I used to be, and the closer to a fight, I get worse. I feel that I need to go out there and do a serious job. I want to take him out. I want to literally beat him, not just win. It changes me. And it must change them, the soldiers, a lot. Kenny mused aloud that it must be hard to come back to normal society after functioning on that level for so long. He can offer only his own example. I'm not the most fun person to be around, especially near a fight. You prepare your mind to suffer and inflict suffering. You delete a part of your compassion. There's a certain amount of brutality to offer violence. Or you're vulnerable. I didn't always feel that way. Before the Shirk fight, it was always just part of my job, just compete. Now, I want to kill that guy. Whatever I can do within the rules with the utmost brutality. I won't hesitate. Every fight, there's more wood on the fire. More bad intentions the closer I get. I've been programmed. Because without it, you're a sitting duck. Kenny recounts the conversation with Rob Kamen. Rob had trouble deprogramming after he retired. He'd beat up the guys he was training with the pads, or he'd knock them out sparring. He couldn't shut down the intensity. His students, who were paying him for the training, couldn't handle him. He kept fucking them up. Rob told Kenny, "Certain people have it or they don't, but you have to feed it. The fire may be there, but it needs fuel. Some people don't have that spark, and you need it or you'll get hurt." Kenny remembers one guy in particular, a special forces soldier who approached him for an autograph with his arm in a sling. The guy's eyes were so incredibly intense, and his energy was so focused, and they just bullshitted, but the guy made an impression. His eyes, his aura, stuck in Kenny's mind. Afterward, Kenny found out the guy was a war hero. I remember Dan Gable talking about the intensity in the room. You had to have examples of it. For fighters to know what is possible, you need to have examples. These soldiers had shown Kenny a different kind of focus, and he'd soaked it up. For them, it's life on the line, and I thought about that for my next fight. It's either him or me. Being ready to die, going back to that samurai mentality. Today is a good day to die. You have to be ready for that, to leave everything out there. I think I had some understanding of the mentality, but going into that fight now, I know I need to kill him before he kills me. It's life or death. I'm gonna destroy him. I see some of this intensity in sparring when Kenny becomes another person entirely. Savage, focused, and explosive. His will is palpable. He seems like the biggest guy in the room. But afterward, relaxed and laughing, Kenny makes something clear. I focus on destroying him, but emotions have no place. They can be good or bad, but emotions always run out. You can't fight on emotion or adrenaline. At the end of the day, you have to have a love for it, something that lasts forever, because that will carry you. You can only be mad for so long. It can help you, but any time you make decisions based on emotions, you'll make a decision without all the information. It's inconsistent. He continues, "Whereas if I'm just focused on the techniques and strategy of the fight, on the fluidity of the fight, on what needs to be done tactically, then I'll make the right decisions. Instead of just being mad, 'Oh, he punched me, I'll punch him.' That changes things. You need to be able to stay calm. Okay, I got hit. That hurt, but I got to find the right way to hurt him back." Kenny confesses a secret to me toward the end of our last day. It goes back to our shared youth, the infatuation with action heroes and the perfect fight. where all your punches and kicks land cleanly, and none of his do. Kenny confides that being the champ would be great, but for me, I got into this, and it's grown into a monster. It's about me doing the perfect technique, doing something beautiful, like a painting, with accuracy, speed, power, timing, the best kick, the best punch, the purest and best technique. Like the old Bruce Lee stuff, but real. I'm so far away from that, and it's bigger than the sport, bigger than a title or fans or anything. With that in mind, I'd much rather go for it with all my heart than run the clock out to grind out the win. I wouldn't feel good about the win. It wouldn't feel real. I asked Kenny, what is the last thing he thinks right before the bell rings, and he's staring across the cage, and he smiles. He loves that moment. I just get excited. Here we go, like I'm a painter with a blank canvas. Since we spoke, I watch Kenny fight with newfound interest and respect, because he consistently improves so much. He is a fighter who changes dramatically from fight to fight. In his last fight with Joe Stevenson, a fight I thought would be really tough for him, he dominated and looked beautiful doing it, graceful. His footwork was smooth, his punches and kicks crisp and lightning quick, and his ground game simple, pure, and inexorable. And he knew it. The moment the fight was through, he covered his face with his hands, one step closer to painting his masterpiece. The ego is garbage. What is a good man but a bad man's teacher? What is a bad man but a good man's job? If you don't understand this, you will get lost, however intelligent you are. It is the great secret. Lao Tzu. There was a video making the round some years ago of former UFC champ Frank Shamrock working on a Pilates ball. He was doing things that nobody had seen before, flowing over the ball like water, flipping, turning and spinning, balletic and pure. Was it related to MMA or grappling? It looked like something out of Cirque du Soleil. It was graceful, beautiful to watch, the weird private workout of a strange figure in the MMA world. Frank Shamrock rides an unsteady place in MMA history. He was a dominant champion in the UFC before the sport fully evolved, and he retired from MMA early in his career, when there weren't many good fights left for him. At times, he seemed supernaturally good, working in a different league than everyone else. At other times, he's been all too human. He's retained some of that aura of effortless invincibility, even when he loses. He seemed like an athlete from the future. And indeed, when MMA began to surge in popularity, Frank emerged from retirement. Older and wiser, however, he took control of his career. He never returned to the UFC, which he calls "You Fight Cheap." He's had a love-hate relationship with longtime MMA fans, sometimes coming across as arrogant and sneering, other times as the epitome of the humble martial artist. When I drove out to San Jose to meet Frank at his gym, he was remarkably reasonable, relaxed, and businesslike. But every now and again, a flash of a fighter's ego would shine through. The silly self-focus of celebrity would make its presence felt. His handsome, battered face could split with a jackal grin, one tooth sharp and snaggled, and a slightly wild look in his eyes. I set out the tape recorder and sat down on the mats, and Frank stretched and started to talk. There is little mystery as to why Frank is the way he is. It's where he's from. Frank was born Alicio Juarez III in 1972 in Santa Monica, California, and had a hard youth. I was a pretty serious juvie delinquent, he laughed, but there wasn't any humor in his voice. I left home at 11 and was a ward of the state until I was 19. The state was my mom and dad. There's something about how he said it, a catch in his voice. A veil drawn by a self-made man over a wound that will never quite heal. It was a joke. As long as you don't hurt anybody, you can do anything. We'd have huge parties, steal cars, wreak havoc. But as long as you didn't hurt anyone, they'd just send you along to the next place. Frank wasn't a street fighter, though. He disliked violence and could remember only a few scraps that he couldn't avoid. He came to the idea of fighting late. Though Frank hadn't played many sports besides partying, he was a natural athlete. You can tell he was one of those odd kids who had all the gifts to make it. Brawn, brains, looks, but without the family support and stability to guide him. So he drifted, alone. He dabbled in volleyball, soccer, and even pitched in Little League, but he never fought much, or even wrestled. I went to wrestling camp, and the first day a couple of guys went out partying, had a great time but got in some fights and caused trouble, and they assumed it was me who led them astray, he laughs, this time with genuine merriment. That was the end of my wrestling career. The coach kicked me out. Frank eventually found his way to Bob Shamrock, who ran the Shamrock Ranch, a foster home for boys in Susanville, California. Bob had a favorite adopted son who'd taken his name, Ken Shamrock. Ken was a promising athlete and the alpha boy at the ranch, and he would become one of the founding fighters of modern MMA. He lost to Royce Gracie in a couple of early UFCs and had a good understanding of the ground game from training in Japan for Pancrase. Pancrase was a promotion formed by Masakatsu Funaki, a bored pro wrestler, a submission wizard who wanted to fight as the first ever pro wrestling group with no preordained finishes, to quote Paul Lazenby, a fighter and a commentator. This was in 1993, the year the UFC started in the United States. The idea, like so many ideas, was floating in the ether. Ken Shamrock was one of their early stars. Ken was very much the image of a fighter, with a superhero body of muscles, a square chin, and a G.I. Joe haircut. Ken eventually went to pro wrestling and was billed, in his prime with some veracity, as the world's most dangerous man. The three Shamrocks have had a tempestuous relationship over the years. At one point, when Frank was 16, Bob and Ken went to North Carolina to pursue Ken's pro wrestling career and kicked Frank back into the system. What that must have felt like to a 16-year-old boy is hard to fathom. A few years later, Bob and Ken returned to California, and Frank was formally adopted. Frank started training with his new brother and found he enjoyed the fight training. I was very, very competitive. I go 100%, and I want to be good or terrible. I loved submission wrestling because it was singular, self-driven. In volleyball, I'd go crazy and try to be everywhere at once, and guys were loafing. Frank took to it like a fish to water, and remembers, it only took a few months to start beating those around me. Ken, my first teacher, taught me the basics, catch-as-catch-can wrestling. It was the simple stuff, movement, position, submission. But I loved it, and I studied it like a science and progressed fast. I wrote down everything. I took a very scholastic approach. I saw the whole thing as a game. Just a sport, not a fight. I wasn't encumbered by the idea of winning or dominating. Frank swears he had never been a street fighter, and he often talks about how distasteful he finds violence. Ken was a superstar in the early MMA world, and Frank lurked in his shadow, going to the big fights at the UFC and in Japan as part of Ken's posse. He began to fight, but I had trouble, because I didn't want to hurt people. I didn't really understand the game. He was in awe of his brother, who smashed me at will. The gym was called the Lion's Den, and the brutality of training and hazing new members has become legendary. It was the epitome of the old-school macho MMA gym, the original. Come get your ass kicked if you want to play with the big boys. Frank smiled at me with that hyena grin and said, I had to accept that if I am swordsman, if I pick up the sword, I have to swing it. That's the game. It is what it is. A punch is a punch. And there's a game element and an art element. But it's also a physical altercation. And if I don't go 100%, something bad could happen. Being a professional fighter and not trying to hurt your opponent is the stupidest, most oxymoronic thing. I think it was a fear of being good, of having the skill to hurt if necessary. At the time, I wasn't mature enough to realize that having the skill is wonderful, that it's a blessing. You just need to know what to do with it. Some will fight in the street, some will languish in the middle, wondering if they should commit, and some will be the best fighters in the world. I realized and accepted it, that I loved it, and I accepted what comes with it. I may kill somebody or get famous, but if I'm true to it, then I accept that. From that point on, I smashed everybody. Frank burst into laughter again, content. I thought of Laborio and Freddie Roach and the importance of acceptance. Here I was hearing it again in a slightly different context, perhaps, but it also played to Virgil's comments about perspective. Maybe I was finally getting somewhere. There was a fight early on, John Lober, where I got him in a bunch of different holds, and every time I got something, I'd look over at him and think, hey, time to tap, I got you. But he was fighting. He came from a different place, and he's thinking, just break my leg or I'll get out. He forced me to confront the truth of fighting. It was a big growth moment for me. Frank cackled. Now I'll stomp the head of my closest friend if he's in the cage with me. That's the game. Frank's rise was meteoric. I got really good and famous really fast, he said, and he's right. He started fighting in Pancrase in Japan, and suddenly he was matched, after only a few fights, against Funaki himself, the legend, the guy who had trained his brother, Ken. I had to fight my teacher's teacher. I couldn't touch Ken. Ken could smash me at will. No matter how much I thought about it or visualized, I didn't see how I could beat this guy. So do I just go out there and die? Frank laughed again. Frank taught himself to meditate in hotel rooms in Japan. The logic wasn't there, of a way to beat this guy, he says. And I had so much fear and anxiety. I had to try something. I got inside myself, just trying to calm down. I was sitting in the hotel thinking, oh my God, what am I doing? When I realized I had to relax. So I worked on it. Deep breaths, eyes closed, just thinking about individual techniques. I relaxed, and it worked. I started to do technical visualization. Then I went out there, and Funaki kicked the shit out of me. Frank dissolves into feral cackles, genuine deep amusement. Yeah, he smashed me, but I came back and beat him later. And it never bothered me to lose like that. If I didn't try hard enough, or screwed around, or was out of shape, those losses really bug me. If someone kicks my ass, that was all you, dude. I have tremendous respect for them. Truthfully, that's kind of what I'm looking for. Someone who can do that and push me. A sincerity came through those pat sporting words. A deep underlying need to be challenged. Without a challenge, the top fighter has a hard time staying motivated, staying in the gym and doing what he needs to do. It's fun at first, but after years and years of it, working out acquires a deadly dullness that needs a sharp point to pierce. And on fight day, unless he's facing a really tough challenge, chances are he, A, won't get to show his skills and perform, and B, won't mentally be sharp. Most great fighters perform well only against great challengers. And often, they give lackluster performances against mediocre opponents. For my guys, my fighters who lose, I tell them it's a learning experience. I do my job as a trainer and make sure they're not in there with someone who's just way too good for them, out of their league. So I can honestly say to them, here's a lesson, and if you learn it, it was worth it 100%. Frank studied bodybuilding before he got into fighting. He brought a physical trainer's mindset, an understanding of musculature, anatomy, and force, to his grappling, and later, his striking. I was looking at the body and thinking about the angles and applied force in the holds, the strength and leverage of a body part. I look at someone and can see where they'll be strong, where they'll be weak. Frank's a self-made man. Without an experienced trainer raising him, he was forced to be his own sage and expert. I came up in submission wrestling, but I'm at the point where positions don't matter in my world. Not position for its own sake. How much energy are you expending? How much damage are you applying? And how much damage is being done to you? Those are the big three. I like the endless flow of attacks because it evens out the technical aspects. You may have a good grappler who's 100 times better than me, but when the flow never stops, he has to have the muscular and vascular systems to keep up the pace. Frank and I sat in the dark in a wrestling room, and Frank stretched slowly. He was perfectly content and relaxed, all business. I asked him to describe his mental process, and he willingly lectured, handing out self-evident truths. The mental side is broken into three areas or levels. One, the idea, the visualization or conceiving side. It's hard to equate it to anything other than those positive affirmation, self-help type of things. Olympic skiers visualize the course. For me, I do it for everything I do, not just fighting. Now that I'm commentating on live TV, I play it out in my head a bunch of different times, seeing ways it could go, making sure I hit the points I want to hit. The second part is replicating, just practice. It's hard to believe something will work if you've never pulled it off. You practice the moves. The fighting ones are obvious, but for this last press conference, I rehearsed with the fighters. I walked them through it, got them used to the sound of my voice. It chilled everyone out. The third part is doing, and every time you do it, you get better. It takes less energy and stress. Frank paused in the dark. So, one, two, three, and I end up with a result. But then I evaluate it. I think about changing what I did, and this is where a lot of people fall down. They go through a good process, end up with a result, and think it's just fine. I won, but I went to the hospital afterward. He smiled, his teeth flashing in the gloom. Fighting is like a business. If you did a deal, and you came away with 20% of the company and somebody owns you, you need to do things differently. If you won the fight, but you're in the hospital, did it really work out for you? Frank maintained that this process has helped him check his ego. He knew he had a reputation for being an occasional egomaniac. If my ego was so big, I would never need to visualize anything. I would just do it, and everything would be 100% wonderful, right? I thought of Eddie Bravo's discussion on ego, and Frank had a lot to say about it. Ego is an evil thing. Confidence is important, but ego is something false. Humility is the way to build confidence, and ego is hugely dangerous in this sport, because if you're running on ego, you aren't running on good, clean emotions or cause and effect. You bypass it to support a false idea. It's all garbage. The ego is garbage. The hardest thing about being an MMA fighter is the huge ego boost you get from winning. Not only from yourself, but from your community. I hear, oh, you're the greatest. You don't have to train all the time. Marcelo Garcia made the exact same complaint. Your own community is the hardest on you, because they're in love with ego too, and you have to fight yourself and them now. Anyone can fight. Fighting is easy. But to sustain it, to remain normal and relaxed and grounded within yourself and your community is really challenging. This is related to the other aspect of fighting that Frank has found to be challenging. Fame. Being famous is hard to do. It amplifies everything negative and positive about you. It's amplified by your fans, whoever watches you. I see guys get famous, and that's a big test for them. What will you do with your ego and power and influence now? False ideas about yourself can destroy you, Frank said. For me, I always stay a student. That's what martial arts are about, and you have to use that humility as a tool. You put yourself beneath someone you trust. That's extremely useful. There is a belief in our system, he was referring to his school, that I came up with years ago, that it takes three people to make you into the best person you can be. Somebody better than you, someone equal to you, and someone less than you. People hear that and get freaked out, because they want to be better than everyone, or at least equal. The goal is actually to put yourself as the last person, even if you're the guy in the lead. You can always find something other people are better at. So teach me, show me, let's work on that. If you can accept the humility and understand why it's important, you'll grow so strong in every way. Imagine if you did that to every person you came in contact with. You put yourself underneath them to learn. I always stay a student. Frank launched into one of his favorite topics, his own scientific approach. I study the biomechanics of the human body and look for the angles of strength, where energy is distributed. I break down techniques into how much energy they expend. I go through the technique in my mind, and if your mind sees it, it happened. Whether it's true or not, if your mind saw it, it happened. So I go through these techniques mentally. My confidence gets built up, and I go in and try them. And then I evaluate it, think about how it worked. There's always something that could be better, so you stay a student. One of the things I was interested in was the psych-out games Frank played. He would very famously talk shit. He made it very clear that, at this level, anything was fair game. I listen to people, he said. They will inherently tell the truth about themselves. It always happens. I amplify things they say about themselves, either right or wrong. But the truth is stronger than anything. If you know a guy has bad feet, then he's got bad feet. Just tell the truth. Some people, when they hear something like that, will fight it. They'll argue, oh no, it's not like that. Now the game is on, because you've got a guy defending something you both know is false. He should say, you're so right, and I'm grinding in the gym to make myself better. But ego jumps in. Of course I'm good and my footwork is fantastic. He gives me his now familiar smile. If someone says to me, your hands suck, then I'll be in the gym working on that extra hard for the next 6 months. Everyone has stuff they get nervous about, their personal shit, and if you hang around long enough, they'll volunteer it, or they'll tell somebody else for you. I go after that stuff. Phil Baroni stutters. We know it, he knows it. Most people don't pick up on it, but Phil hasn't made peace with it. When I'd goof on him, he'd get mad. In one press conference, Phil was almost in tears. I get what Frank is about. He's not picking on Phil out of nowhere. He's not just an asshole. Mental toughness is on the table. Now, he's not in a peaceful mind, ready to fight. Now he's somewhere else. Some other issue from when he was a kid. He's not focused on the task or the goal. I talk to people during fights the whole time. I build on what I said beforehand. I picked that up from Boss Rutan. We'd both talk to each other the whole fight, and the ref used to warn us. Boss was funny. He talked to me as a way to pump himself up. I'm so strong, I almost got you. More like Muhammad Ali, to empower himself. What he did wasn't crafted to get into you, but I'm all about that privacy, that inner attack. It's distracting and confusing, and it's supposed to be. If you hear it, it exists. Especially if you're in a high-stress situation, with uncertainty anyway. I look in a guy's eyes, and I talk down low, just for him. I don't want anyone to hear it, but him. Not his corner, not the crowd. So when he goes back to his corner, and his trainer is telling him things, there's another voice he's been hearing. It falls into what he thinks about. This may be why some MMA fans dislike Frank. Shenanigans like this are frowned on in martial arts. But Frank assured me that mental strength and focus are fair targets at this level of fighting. It's part of the game, he kept saying. Frank even confessed to a time when he was head-fucked by another fighter. It was the second time he fought John Lober, and Lober engaged in psychological warfare of a petty nature, ordering room service to Frank's room, sending him threatening emails, prank-calling him, getting personal. It was weird, funny, childish stuff, but it made me upset. I was young. I had to learn. I went out all angry and kicked the shit out of him. But when it was over, I had a big sobering up. I realized, holy shit, I exposed myself, being angry and frustrated. There was a moment when I could have finished him, and I thought, no, I wanted to hurt him. And that could have been really bad. I could have let him off the hook, and he might have come back. I could have hurt myself or gotten hurt. He got in my head, plain and simple. I was reminded of Dan Gable talking about seeing a guy break and staying on him, because if you gave him respite, he could come back. Frank agrees wholeheartedly. You have to stay on him when you see him start to break. My style is to break you. I try to get you to go anaerobic, change your fuel source so you're no longer efficient, or you're afraid of running out of gas, of getting knocked out. I fight at a pace that borderlines aerobic activity, which is hard to do unless you've got good technique. Don't worry so much about positions, but keep the fight flowing at a fast pace. It's a race. The person with the best conditioning and technique should win. I didn't hurt Tito. I made him tired. Frank was talking about his epic battle with Tito Ortiz, one of the great early MMA fights. Frank fought the larger, younger, and angrier Tito for 4 long rounds, And, in a superb technical display, he finally started to take Tito apart in the fourth. Tito tapped because he was exhausted, and I was going to keep beating him. When your dog tired, that lactic acid builds up, and you get sick and nauseous, and you have to do something. You can't keep fighting. It's conditioning. If you push them over the brink, they'll lose everything. They break down. They feel like they could die. Fatigue makes cowards of us all, right? Anytime you can take a technique from somebody, absorb a big blow without damage, stuff a takedown, that's huge. I don't consciously do it. I technically do it. I train for it. If he's got a great uppercut, I shift my hand over and take that away from him. I don't think about it, but I can feel his energy subside when he thinks he's done something good and it doesn't work. You can feel him deflate. I'm always in tune with his energy, his emotions. You fight in front of thousands, but there's only one guy. I hear him breathing. I hear the impacts. And I hear my corner. That's it. Frank found spirituality in what he does, in teaching and training. The core of every religion is a social structure that connects everybody, for the common good of society, he said in a rehearsed line that rolls off his tongue. For me, that's what martial arts is. You teach children to make them better people. You teach adults to give them a better understanding of themselves or of their partner. Some students will ask me to go to church with them on Sunday, and I say, I go to church Monday through Saturday, and Sunday I stay home with my family. That's how I look at it. Everything is always on the line. I first became aware of Josh Waitzkin through a friend from New York who'd played chess with him when they were both kids. Did you ever see that movie Searching for Bobby Fischer? I drew that kid in a game, he said, over a chessboard. We were 9. Not only had I not seen the movie, I hadn't been aware that 9-year-olds played in chess tournaments. When I was 9, I focused on tying my shoes and killing salamanders. When I left Thailand, sailing across the Indian Ocean, I started reading chess books, just because I hadn't studied anything since college. Funnily enough, one of the books I ended up with was Josh Waitzkin's Attacking Chess, written when he was 18. I enjoyed the story more than the chess, which is a common thread for me. I buy chess books and read the introductions. Later, when I was living briefly in Manhattan and studying Tai Chi with William C.C. Chen, I saw pictures on the wall of that same chess kid, Waitzkin, winning push hands tournaments. Push hands is the competition side of Tai Chi, a kind of flowing standing wrestling where you push and pull, trying to either push an opponent out of the ring or fall him. It's pretty fringe in the United States, but a major deal in China and Taiwan, and Josh had gone there and won world championships. Now, push hands is not MMA, but it's also not a joke, especially overseas, where it's taken as seriously as judo. I finally watched Searching for Bobby Fischer, based on a book that Josh's pop had written about Josh's early chess career. It's a great story about a chess prodigy coming to terms with competition and life, and a fascinating look into the cutthroat world of child chess in New York, high-stakes pressure tournaments for 8-year-olds. At the age of 6, Josh had been walking by Washington Square in Manhattan and was lured in by the commotion of street chess. The square has a famous corner where hustlers play for money, raucous as any street basketball court. I've played there, and it's a little rough on the ego to get shit-talked to, then slapped around the board by a black guy with muscled arms bigger than your legs. Josh started playing with these boisterous characters without ever seeing a chessboard before, and he started coming back every day, winning more than he lost. With this rough apprenticeship, he'd gone on to become one of the top young players in the country. His story is powerful, and made more so by his struggle to maintain his identity and hold on to his childhood in a chessic world without mercy. I had picked up a new book Josh had recently written, a non-chess book called The Art of Learning. The back is covered with intimidating quotes. Effusive praise by everyone from Cal Ripken Jr. to Deepak Chopra. You better like it. Fortunately, it's easy to like. It's a great book. An honest and open look into Josh's thought processes, and the lessons he'd gleaned from his study of the world. The book takes into account both his chess and Tai Chi careers, and I would recommend it to anyone. Josh has been in deep waters, at least in chess and Tai Chi, and he's drawn genuine insight from them. At the end of the book, he mentioned he was studying Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and that drew my attention. I knew some people who knew him, so I managed to get in touch. We set up a time to meet in New York. Josh had been a star from 6 years old, immediately labeled special in the eyes of adults, and different than most kids. But then a hit movie about how wonderful you are when you're 15? What could that do to your ego? To be honest, I was pretty sure he was going to be an asshole. It was almost impossible for him not to be. He was taking jiu-jitsu, though, with an eye on competing in the Mundials, the world championship. I thought, perfect. Here's a guy I can talk chess and jiu-jitsu with. If he was an asshole, I could handle it. When I met Josh in New York, he reminded me of Caravaggio's painting of Dionysus. He's a good-looking, normal guy, medium height and thick, with a jiu-jitsu body, rounded and grounded. He had an amiable face, broad nose, and thick, curly black hair, like an Italian farm boy. He laughed easily. Things amused him, and he was intensely curious about the world. He didn't come across as an asshole. He was a relaxed dude with a friendly intensity. We laughed and talked and had coffee, and he was very complimentary about my book, and I about his. We both meant it. Through it all, though, you could feel him watching you with those soft brown eyes. He didn't look like a chess genius. He looked like a Mediterranean peasant. But in his eyes, you could feel it. Suddenly, it made sense. The serious intellect behind there watching you, evaluating you, and cataloging weakness and strength, patterns. Listening intently, watching carefully without self-consciousness. "Tell me," he'd say intently about something, an MMA fighter I knew, some detail from the book, and I'd try and be precise. He was watching for later use, gathering information. Here's a kid who's been playing serious competitive chess since he was 6. Of course he's watching you like that. That's how he grew up. Not all the time, but flashes, here and there. At the end of his chess career, Josh was sort of off balance from the pressures of fame, combined with a chess instructor who tried to lead him down a path away from his natural inclinations. Josh also talks about his emotions. "Now, I don't block them. I use them. I was brittle, locked up, and now I can channel what I need to. It's liberating and far more resilient." He's an incredibly emotional, heart-on-his-sleeve guy, something he freely admits, and which fuels him and his writing. But he learned to use his emotions, let his opponents read him, and then apply tiny emotional changes to mislead. He learned to channel his emotions into useful pathways, to ride them, in control and with understanding. Part of that process was the intensive study of Tai Chi. Josh is aware of how Tai Chi and push hands aren't taken very seriously in the United States. It's about 10% real dudes and 90% people with mystical delusions. "But that 90% gives the rest of it a bad name," Josh said ruefully over sake and sushi. "At least 6 times I've had guys tell me they can't spar me because their chi is so strong they'd kill me." He shakes his head and laughs. "They brainwash students. The better the student, the farther the master sends them flying with a bump of the wrist. I watched this one guy send his top students bouncing off the walls. He even knocked his prize student around without touching her. But when I asked to spar, it was, 'I'm sorry, I'd kill you.' In Asia, there are real athletes training hard, like real martial artists. It's so different." Toward the end of his Tai Chi career, Josh became aware of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. He studied Jiu-Jitsu in the Gi, and he was a brown belt when I met him. He'd already come a long way. He was highly motivated, trained every day, and loved it. A lot of guys would have come in and tried to jam Tai Chi ideas to Jiu-Jitsu right away, he said. "I knew that would be a mistake. I was out in L.A., and I went to John Machado's school. I had done all these push-hands competitions, so in the stand-up I could handle them, but on the ground, I was getting tapped every 10 seconds. John knew about me, and about chess, too." Josh studied with John Machado in 2005, for 9 months, twice a day, and then back in New York with Marcos Santos, eventually getting his brown belt from Marcos and Hegan Machado. I asked him about learning jiu-jitsu. The biggest error I see in any discipline is people taking on too much too fast. Depth over breadth, man. I believe in diving deeply into a small pool of information. For instance, when you learn a new move in jiu-jitsu, learn something on one side of the body, learn it very deeply, then learn it on the other side when you've developed that deep feel. Josh is no Superman, gifted with extraordinary speed and strength, but he's no shrinking violet either. He's not a skinny chess nerd with the glasses taped together. He's an athlete. But he was also without illusion. He was aware that he had a big advantage in the psychological game, because that is such a major part of chess. He'd been evaluating and psyching out opponents his whole life. It was clear that his true strengths are in his intensity and his focus on learning, his art of learning. From his books, you come to understand his drive, his commitment to incredibly hard work. He put in the time. As a child playing chess, he put in the time studying endgames, mastering them, and it gave him the confidence to survive the killer openings that other children memorized. He puts in the time not only in chess, but in Tai Chi and in Jiu-Jitsu. He blazes for his 10,000 hours with pure gameness. Sure, he's gifted, but he's immensely driven underneath his sunny exterior. There's a subtle difference to, say, Gable's intensity, which feels joyless, from a deep, relentless place. Josh's intensity is easier, colored with excitement. It's playful. Of course, I'm not sitting across the board or rolling with him. Josh had a funny story, well-polished but useful, about observation. We had been talking about tells, when an opponent does something that subconsciously reveals his inner state. The classic use is in poker, when someone is bluffing and they always act a certain way, maybe tap their fingers. They have a tell. When you pick it up, then they try to trick you with it. In chess, an opponent might lay a trap and hope you fall into it, pretending to have made a bad move. When Josh was a kid, he remembers acting, slapping his head. But as he got older and his needs more subtle, just a change of breathing, a slightly tense expression might suffice. Guys were very aware of their tells at the high level, so they'd use them to mislead you. But off the board, they weren't as aware. So I got good at reading people off the board. In Bermuda every year, there was a 2-week tournament where a dozen world-class chess players would live in this resort together and play chess all day. So everyone is walking on the beach, swimming and studying each other. And some of these guys are truly brilliant people. But watch them get caught in the rain. There are these squalls that rip through Bermuda, and I would sit on a cliff and watch other players get caught in the rain. Some guys would stand there, breathe it in, and get wet. They'd look out at the ocean. Other guys would put their hands over their head and run desperately for cover. When you observe that kind of moment, when people are caught off guard, you can start to see how they are as humans and competitors. If they put their hands up and run, they're controllers. So, over the chessboard, you take a critical moment and you make it chaotic, out of control. Make it so they have to embrace the unknown to perform. But if they stand and just get wet and enjoy the rain, then maybe they embrace chaos. That was the kind of player I was. So for them, you create a position where it takes painstaking, mind-numbing calculation to succeed. Of course, you can't always control the board to that extent, but often you can give them a choice, where the correct decision is to go a certain way, and the incorrect decision is to go to their own style, and often they'll take the disadvantage. They'll shy away and give you a slightly better position. It might sound odd to non-chess players to hear talk of the correct decision when chess seems so open and free form. That is one of the big surprises about chess. When you start to study it, there is almost always a correct move, a best move. To the beginner, the chessboard seems a vast, mysterious place where an infinite variety of things could happen. But as you learn more, you start to see how the game plays and where the best move is. At the very high level, there's sometimes uncertainty between a few best moves. Most of the time, there is a right decision, though, and one best move. There is an interesting correlation with MMA, where I've observed better strikers getting outstruck by tough grapplers. The reason is slightly insidious. It's not that the grappler had better striking. It's that the striker was so terrified of the takedown, so concerned about being outclassed on the ground, that he constricts his striking game. The grappler, unconcerned with being taken down, can let it all hang out and swing for the fences. Josh has refined these psychological manipulations in chess, has used them in Tai Chi, and is starting to apply them to jiu-jitsu. As you focus on the opponent, his emotions and yours come into play. Josh talks of shared illusions. He remembers playing in the under-18 World Chess Championship tournament in an important round against the Vietnamese national champ. They were deep in a very positional game when his opponent hung a rook. Basically, his opponent made a beginner's blunder. He gave Josh a piece on an error. The error that was so weirdly obvious, so big, that it was almost impossible for Josh to see. When you read the game now, it's simply mystifying. They were both embroiled in computations of this deep position, getting deeper and deeper, and missing the obvious, but feeding on each other. Josh sat there calculating for 15 minutes and then moved, missing the blunder that would have handily won him the game. Eventually, his opponent saw the mistake he'd made, but Josh never did. One of the U.S. coaches almost had a heart attack, he confessed ruefully. I ended up winning, but I could have taken his rook, Josh muses. It's astonishing at that level. He sighs. Now, although I am far, far below that level, I have been in similar situations in chess many times, where I am so focused and calculating, I miss an obvious change that the opponent's new move is created, or a position has gotten so complicated that I remove a base without realizing it's supporting my whole house. It's not just that. It's that both of us missed it, and we feel each other. I've made a move and sat there waiting and watching and suddenly realized I made a huge mistake. But if I don't react, if I successfully conceal my emotions, sometimes he won't see it either. But usually, just me noticing it, the change in tension, will give it away. Josh talked about shared illusions in jiu-jitsu. Once you beat somebody once, they sometimes get convinced that you're just better than them. And now you're tapping them every 15 seconds, when in the beginning, there was a real struggle. You see it in MMA fights all the time. One fighter avoids the takedown a few times, and both fighters become convinced that the guy can't be taken down. Josh talks about variations on the psychic connection between two opponents. You might prepare these openings and have 1,000 variations thought out, but there is one problem that is haunting you, one offbeat line you haven't prepared. It's a needle in a haystack, so you play the opening hoping your opponent won't find the hole. But he will if he's a grandmaster. It's like he smells it. At the high levels, the minds connect. It reminds me a little of my friend Javier Calderon, a filmmaker who is also a professional boxer. Javier has been a sparring partner in camps with some of the best fighters in the world, and he is a regular at the Wild Card Boxing Club. He recalls he was sparring a young kid, who was a better boxer, who moved well. But Javier was stalking him for 3, 4, 5 rounds, chasing him around the ring. Javier said, "Because he can't hurt me, I'm stronger, and he knows I know it, or even he knows I know he knows it." The level of connection went deep. When Josh was competing in the push hands in Taiwan, he ran into an opponent who could read his intentions so well that Josh was sure the guy could read his mind. No tricks could fool him. Here was an opponent whose skill was so great and perception so powerful that he was inside Josh's head with him. But Josh beat this wizard by turning that very sensitivity against him. He started to just think about feints instead of fainting. He used his intentions to mislead. "You're gonna read my mind? Okay, well, I'll use that against you. I'll think about the wrong thing. Another man's sword is your sword." People are usually too aware of tells. You're looking for them, but they know it, and they're going to be illusory. They'll be manipulating you with their own tells. So I plant mini patterns on an opponent, in Tai Chi and Jiu Jitsu. I give them dogma, a false construct. I convince them that A leads to B, A leads to B, and then suddenly, when A doesn't lead to B anymore, they're fucked. False assumptions. He laughed. But that was exactly